Who's there?
Barry, answer me. Stand and unfold yourself.
Relax, fellas, it's just me.
Leonardo?
I got a new episode about Hamlet. I thought you'd like to hear it.
You come most carefully upon your hour. For this relief, much thanks. It is bitter cold, and I am sick at heart.
Oh, tuck yourself up in bed with a nice cup of tea and have a listen.
Well, good night.
Night. Tell the other guards that there's a new episode, yeah?
I think I hear them. Stand hold! Who's there?
It's just the litter bug and some clubhousers.
Give you good night.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to my little piece of the cloud. This is the Classic English Literature Podcast, the show that gives rhyme its reason. Litterbugs, today's episode is a big one, and one that I've been both excited and honestly anxious about. See, today, we're tackling that greatest of all plays, the pinnacle of English literary excellence, the plumbed depths of human experience. Yes, that's right. Today, it's Shakespeare's magnificent octopus, the tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Now, pals for life, Hamlet is my absolute most favoritest book in the whole wide world ever and forever. I love Hamlet the way I love buffalo wings, hot and messy. Ew. But the play looms so large in our cultural imaginations. Like, nearly everyone can quote a line from it. Nearly everyone is familiar with the image of the young prince holding a skull. Everyone has an opinion or theory or hypothesis, and so I just feel really intimidated. It's impossible to do it justice. But we're going to have a go. And before we do, please remember that the potty's email is classicenglishliterature@gmail.com, so slip me a missive. Alternatively, you can get hold of me at any of the social media platforms which do so much to shatter salutary social relations. And if you can spare a dime, click the Support the Show button. Do take a moment to leave a positive review on your favorite podcatcher. I am ever your most humble and obedient servant, so long as this machine is to him, McDonough. As we've noted before, Shakespeare's great thematic obsessions seem to be kingship and parent-child relations, and this play covers both deeply. In fact, you may know that Shakespeare's own son, named Hamnet, died at the age of 11 in 1596, just a few years before this monumental play, whose title character shares the lost child's name. Spelling was not so regularized in the early modern period, and Warwickshire West Midlands accents can make the names basically identical. But this play that meditates so deeply on loss and death and estrangement and the mysteries of human relationships can have no more poignant name. Now, the textual history of this most famous of plays is rather complicated. In the Stationer's Register of 1602, we find an entry reading, quote, "A book called The Revenge of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, as it was lately acted by the Lord Chamberlain, his servants." So we know the play came about at the latest by 1601, but most scholars figure a 1599 starting date for composition and probably 1600 for the first performances. Whence came this play? Well, we're not sure exactly. Sometimes we hear about an earlier version. It's sometimes called the Hamlet, being a German prefix meaning primitive or original. But no copy of the Hamlet survives, and no one's sure who wrote it. Maybe it was Thomas Kyd, he of the Spanish tragedy, that first blockbuster of a revenge play. And maybe it was Shakespeare himself, an early draft just lost in the mists of time. The story of the play, the ghost of a slain father conjures his son to revenge, the son feigning madness to fool the suspects, That seems to come originally from a Scandinavian folk story that circulated orally, though there are ancient analogues from Greece and Byzantium, as well as a tale of the Roman Brutus. The Icelandic Saga of Hrolf Kraki probably influenced Danish historian Saxo Grammaticus, who, in the early 12th century, placed the tale in his manuscript Historica Danica, or Gesta Danorum, take your pick, which came out as a published volume in 1514. Now, Saxo gives us the murder of a Danish king by his brother Fengo, who then marries the widow Garutha, the feigned madness of the avenging prince Amleth, and his trip to England. Now note the similarity in names. You just take the H off the end of Amleth, pop it round front, and you get Hamlet. Pretty close to the story we know, right? But Shakespeare probably didn't read old Saxo. Elizabethans got the tale third-hand by a French writer rejoicing in the name of François de Belfort, who brought out his Histoire Tragique in 1570 and made a great smash. In the lubricious Gallic tradition, he makes sure we know that the queen and her brother-in-law have been engaging in quite scandalous behavior all along. Ooh la, and if I may, la. And that the prince is a melancholic, you know, black turtleneck, beret, insouciantly smoking a Galois. Etru ne pas etre. Well, sorry for that. Belforest's is probably where Kidd or Shakespeare or whoever got the bones of Hamlet. The play we now call Hamlet, the one by Shakespeare noted in the Stationer's Register, exists in three versions. The earliest we call the first quarto, published in 1603, and it suffers from the sobriquet the Bad Quarto. It diverges in significant ways from the second quarto of 1604 and the first folio of 1623. Not least by the fact that it is about half as long, which may not be a bad thing given an oak bench's tendency to produce a sore bottom. There are a number of line changes. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I, from quarto two, replaces why, what a dunghill idiot slave am I, from the first quarto. I mentioned this in the last subscast episode on Shakespeare's first folio, but the to-be soliloquy is completely altered, and the queen is called Gertrude, and Ophelia is an adept lutenist. Yes. Unsuspected depth. Classroom texts today are usually carefully edited hybrids of the authorized versions found in Q2 and the folio. So let's dash out a quick and dirty for those three or four of you who don't know the story. I should also note, perhaps, that what follows in this episode makes frequent references to suicide, so take that as you will. We open on the turrets of Elsinore Castle in Denmark, where nervous guards speak of a ghostly vision of the recently deceased king. They resolve to tell Prince Hamlet of his father's spirit. Meanwhile, the new king Claudius, brother to the previous, has married the widow Gertrude and celebrates his coronation. He dispatches ambassadors to Norway in order to quell a threat from Fortinbras, a young prince bent on avenging his late father's defeats at Denmark's hands. He then allows his chancellor's son to return to Paris, but denies that his nephew, now stepson, Prince Hamlet, returned to study in Wittenberg. Hamlet is then told about the apparition on the battlements, and he goes to see for himself. When the ghost appears, it accuses Claudius of murdering old King Hamlet and charges young Prince Hamlet with avenging the crime. The prince decides that the best way to avenge fratricide is to pretend to be mad. Hamlet's moodiness becomes a concern for the king and queen, who summon old school friends to find out what's going wrong. Your father dead, mother remarried, seeing ghosts? Why so glum, Hamlet? Polonius, the chancellor, believes it must be frustrated love for his daughter Ophelia that has turned the lad's mind. A company of traveling actors arrives, and Hamlet has them put on a play that mirrors the circumstances of his father's death. When Claudius reacts poorly to the performance, Hamlet takes this as prima facie evidence of guilt and proceeds to go to his mother's private rooms, harangue her for her lasciviousness, and kill Polonius, accidentally, while the old man creeps behind a curtain. Well, that drives Ophelia mad, and she drowns herself, probably. Her brother Laertes returns from Paris at the head of a mob seeking to kill Claudius to avenge Polonius' death. But instead, Claudius convinces him to have a fencing match with Hamlet. They'll poison Laertes' sword and a drink so that Hamlet is sure to snuff it. Hamlet, having conversed with the skull of a childhood friend, is now more zen about death and plays the match. Swords get switched, poison gets drunk, and everybody dies. Only Horatio, Hamlet's truest friend, remains to see young Fortinbras capture Elsinore and declare himself king. It's an odd story when you boil it down like that, isn't it? I mean, the revenge-y stuff is pretty straightforward, intense, a bit trashy, like the Spanish tragedy. But then there's all the odd stuff. Like, why is feigning madness a sound strategy here? Is a play really an unimpeachable method of establishing criminal culpability? And what about the whole pirate interlude? Yes, I forgot to mention that earlier. Pirates are key to Hamlet's denouement. Looking at the play like this, it's hard to imagine why it has captured the hearts and minds of millions down the centuries. Regular listeners will know that I try to organize my reading particular text around a single idea or theme or insight. Now, never, I repeat never, do I presume that such an explication exhausts the text under discussion. But I try to offer a general understanding of the work for readers unfamiliar with the readings, as well as one of my own idiosyncratic thoughts for listeners who may already know the text but are interested in another vantage point. But I don't know how to squeeze all the things I think are important or interesting about this play into a single thesis. And I simply don't have the time or space to go into all the things that make Hamlet probably the greatest literary creation in history. Oh, am I being hyperbolic? Perhaps, but I don't think so. So what I'm going to do is offer a series of thoughts and observations about various aspects of the play. They will not be comprehensive, and they'll probably not come to any tidy conclusion, but I offer them for your amusement and edification. But this'll be a long episode, folks, so you're going to want to have a pee first. I'll wait. Allow me to begin at the beginning. The first line of Hamlet is one of drama's great openings. Quote, "Who's there?" So simple, yet so pregnant with possibility. Of course, it establishes that sense of dread and suspense. It casts a pall over the coronation scene which follows, makes us doubtful. And we should also note the sense of claustrophobic surveillance that looms over the entire play. A sense that one is never really alone, that one is trapped in the panoptic gaze of the Danish court. Everyone watches everyone else. Polonius and Claudius spy on Hamlet and Ophelia in the lobby. Polonius hides behind the arras while Hamlet and Gertrude speak. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, two of the prince's schoolmates who have been summoned by the king and queen, they lurk in every room. Gertrude follows Ophelia. Hamlet eavesdrops on Claudius, and Claudius follows the prince's every move. Everyone watches the players, and Horatio, Hamlet's best friend, has a keen eye on the king. The ghost lowers over all. And what about that ghost? Is it really Hamlet's father? Is it, as Hamlet asks, quote, "a spirit of health or goblin damned?" Who's there? Further, that brief question immediately points us to, I think, the primary concern of the play. And that's the self, the I. Who is there? Who am I? What do we mean by the self? Can we fully know it? Can we fully know others? These profound questions of psychology and identity undergird the entire play, inflect every facet of plot, character, and theme. Harold Bloom, the late scholar at Yale, has asserted that with Hamlet, Shakespeare invents what it is to be human, what it means to be human, and what anxieties accompany that realization. It's often noted that Prince Hamlet expresses the entire range of human emotions. He's mournful, fearful, loving, bitter, enraged, depressed, playful, and on and on. To what extent do various emotional states complicate our notion of a single, unitary self? Who's there? When you think about it this way, the oft-quoted but seldom contextualized bit of advice by Polonius, quote, "To thine own self be true," that becomes troublingly ironic. Shakespeare weaves a number of motifs throughout the text to probe this idea. For instance, like clothing images and metaphors pop up frequently. When Mother Gertrude asks why he seems so melancholy, Hamlet replies that is not his, quote, "inky cloak, nor customary suits of solemn black that make him so sad." He actually is sad. And when Laertes readies to return to Paris, Father Polonius advises, quote, "costly thy habit as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy, rich not gaudy, for the apparel oft proclaims the man." We get two rather different notions here. Hamlet says that his clothing cannot, quote, "denote him truly," while Polonius seems to say that how you appear is how people will understand your character. Now, along with the clothing motif, the play abounds with references to makeup, cosmetics, and usually, it must be admitted, does so in rather misogynistic ways. Accusing a bewildered Ophelia of duplicity, Hamlet shouts, quote, "I have heard of your paintings too well enough. God hath given you one face, and you make yourselves another." In the famous graveyard scene, as he stares at a skull, Hamlet mocks, quote, "Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick, to this favor she must come." In his soliloquy, Claudius refers to his own treachery with an ugly metaphor, a prostitute who uses makeup to hide her syphilis scars. Quote, "The harlot's cheek, beautied with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my deed to my most painted word." But perhaps the most persistent and complex trope Shakespeare employs is that of the theater itself, the idea of performance and pretense, acting and enacting. Repeatedly, the play hammers this conceit. Hamlet refers to false grief as mere pantomime. Quote, "Nor windy suspiration of forced breath, no, nor the fruitful river in the eye, nor the dejected havior of the visage, together with all forms, moods, shapes of grief that can denote me truly, these indeed seem, for they are actions that a man might play. But I have that within which passes show, these but the trappings and the suits of woe." But then he's powerfully moved when the player recites the speech of Aeneas' tale to Dido. Quote, "Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage waned? Tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing, for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her?" How could a man, Hamlet asks, summon such genuine emotion for a figment of the imagination? How could this not be real? And how much more real, he thinks, is his own situation, the destruction of his family? And he can summon no action at all. And then, of course, there are the obvious metadramatic moments. Hamlet lecturing the players on the proper way to act. The strange divergence into complaining about child actors, which is perhaps a timely complaint of the bard himself, there having been at the turn of the 17th century rather a vogue for what were called boys' companies, acting troupes consisting exclusively of children who were cutting into ticket sales at the proper theaters. We also get Hamlet's complaint about comic actors stealing the scene, going off script, and improvising when, quote, some necessary question of the play be then to be considered. Shakespeare having a go at his own rambunctious clowns? Perhaps Will Kemp, notorious for hogging the stage? There's a lovely in-joke before the play within a play when Hamlet asks about Polonius's own acting experience. The Chancellor says that, quote, I didn't act Julius Caesar. I was killed at the Capitol. Brutus killed me. Now, litterbugs who listened to the last episode will know all about that play. But here's an interesting bit of trivia. Julius Caesar is generally reckoned to be the play Shakespeare's company put on the season before Hamlet. And the actor who played Caesar was also the actor who plays Polonius. Symmetrically, the actor who played Brutus is the same as he who played Hamlet. So regular theatergoers at the time would have recognized Shakespeare's knowing nod to their experience. And that, of course, is another metadramatic point. All of this is, really, a performance played out before a real audience. That audience, as we ourselves, could also not fail to notice the prismatic structure of the drama, its sense of mirror images in the various plot strands. And of course, we have the main line in which Hamlet must avenge the death of his father. We've already heard that young Fortinbras has raised an army to reconquer the territories lost by his father to old Hamlet, and while he acts with decision, Hamlet hesitates and reflects. Laertes, too, becomes the avenging son when he storms Elsinore at the head of a mob, demanding justice for his father's death. And we can also see, in some way, Ophelia as a foil for the protagonist as well. And more on that later. I'd like to spend the rest of the show looking at some of the characters. Seems obvious to begin with the title character, and so I will. His is the role that is every actor's Everest, a must-conquer if you take your craft seriously. And undoubtedly a difficult climb, given that the emotional dimensions of Prince Hamlet are so multifarious. Some famous actor, can't remember who, said something like, the best way to prepare for Hamlet is to simplify, just pick one thing, one state of mind, one motivation upon which to focus. Let everything else go, because it's a role too massive for any single performer or any single performance. A short introduction, as this episode is, will certainly not exhaust Hamlet's immense complexity, but I'd like to point out a few things that I find interesting. The young prince occupies kind of a liminal space. He's like a man standing over a tectonic fault line. The plates are shifting, the earth quakes, and he doesn't know if it's better to jump right or left. He's a modern young man stuck in a medieval world. Remember that he's a scholar. He studies at the University of Wittenberg. And Shakespeare wants us to know this, as both Claudius and Gertrude specify the institution in rapid succession. Now, we've mentioned this German city a couple of times in previous episodes because it was the site of one of the greatest tectonic shifts in Western civilization. Remember? Here, in 1517, Martin Luther challenged the institutional Roman Catholic Church on 95 different points, a startling provocation of a thoroughgoing hegemony. The site stands, in Hamlet, as it does relatedly in Marlowe's Faustus, actually, as a metonym for progressive thinking, humanism, individualism, new ways of knowing. Throughout the play, we get glimpses of Hamlet's immersion in the emerging Renaissance culture. Not only his thorough familiarity with classical drama and rhetoric, as evidenced by his interaction with the players, but his allusion to Copernican understandings of the cosmos in that quizzical love poem to Ophelia, his references to infinity and his quite material interest in the human body. This humanist scholar is thrust back into the world, basically, of Beowulf, or soon thereafter. We reckon the events of the source material to the early 11th century, so perhaps a century after Beowulf's transcription. But be that as it may, Hamlet is back in a world of comitatus and the revenge ethic, an early medieval world in which nuance resolves into traditional certainties. All the great questions have been settled by heritage and custom. The prince in this world would be a warrior, a martial figure, like Fortinbras, not a philosopher poet. Hamlet is decidedly not a chip off the old block. Attendant to this, he is also, effectively, a Protestant man in a Catholic world. While the revenge ethic is a feature of the pagan Germanic belief system, the prompt to it, the ghost of old Hamlet, has some really old faith vibes. On the battlements, he tells the bewildered prince, quote,
"I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain time to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast in fires till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away."
Sure seems like he's referring to purgatory, that stop before heaven wherein the departed soul suffers tortures to reconcile it to God. And this is a peculiarly Catholic notion. The Protestants have no time for this. In fact, at the time of Shakespeare's writing, an endorsement of such doctrines could, in fact, be dangerous. But here, Shakespeare seems to be hiding behind the ghostly convention of Senecan tragedy. Protestant theology holds that the departed soul moves to heaven or hell immediately, that God has predestined one's post-mortem address, or that the faith of the believer has guaranteed it. Catholic teaching on ghosts is generally on the skeptical side. But in the early modern period, people generally were more disposed to believe. Whether or not souls could return from purgatory in Catholic theology is, I admit, somewhat unclear to me. I don't believe they can, which complicates our little father-son reunion a bit. But there are some traditions that allow for, like a bit of a furlough if there's a special mission to accomplish. Hard for me to believe, though, that personal revenge qualifies, given the whole, turn-the-other-cheek outlook of Christ's teaching. And whatever. We've got these pagan and Catholic ingredients, a purgatorial soul enforcing the comitatus bond. Is Hamlet a Protestant, though? Well, I admit that's difficult to ascertain. Despite the prince's general loquaciousness, he is peculiarly mum about any personal religious convictions. To be sure, he makes reference to heaven and hell, but his conceptions of them are inconsistent, and he seems to endorse a sort of Christian morality and conception of the world, but a Bible thumper he is not. He strikes me as more like Christian by culture than by conviction. Any putative Protestantism in his character is more the result of a humanist education in a Christian country. His last words, quote, "the rest is silence," are characteristically ambiguous. This young man, who, at 1,500 lines, is Shakespeare's most voluble, has finally stopped talking. He's nothing else to say. But perhaps he also means rest, not simply as, remainder, but as respite, repose. That is silent. There is nothing after this life. And that relief works with the anxiety about the afterlife, actually. And, perhaps punching his own ticket to it, which is evident in the soliloquies. His very first, quote, "Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. or that the Everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. That first soliloquy, he recognizes the divine proscription against suicide. But in this speech, Hamlet is quite clearly emotionally distraught, almost babbling. He jumps from subject to subject. And interestingly, the folio gives us solid flesh, a material body melting, changing states of matter. The quartos give us sallied or sullied flesh, that is, a body that has been corrupted and so must be destroyed. The second soliloquy, "What a rogue and peasant slave am I?" I mentioned that one earlier. Here is where he wonders at the player's ability to summon emotion for a fiction. But at the end of this speech, Hamlet directly addresses us, the audience, and asks us a direct question. Quote, "Am I a coward?" Wow. Is his failure to sweep to his revenge the result of a lack of Beowulfian fortitude? His answer is bitter self-loathing. Which brings us neatly to the great third soliloquy, the to be or not to be. Hamlet rationally asks what Albert Camus, the 20th century author and philosopher, called the only essential philosophical question: should I kill myself? Camus says in The Myth of Sisyphus, "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. All the rest, whether or not the world has three dimensions, whether the mind has 9 or 12 categories, comes afterwards. These are games one must first answer." Now, Hamlet goes to the root here, and the first line of the soliloquy, too, is ambiguous, depending on how one chooses to read the pentameter rhythm. If we read the line straight, with a regular iambic rhythm, we get, "To be or not to be, that is the question." In the second half of the line, the beat falls on the verb is, so we get an indicative statement, sort of a philosophical predicate upon which he can base the rest of his inquiry. But if we allow a little syncopation, shall we say, and like a swinging jazz drummer, pop a trochee in as the fourth foot, the emphasis falls on that. Here, Hamlet has just realized the truth of Camus' assertion. That is the question.
Oh.
And the fact that in this speech he's not emotionally overwrought, not ranting, though there is a mixed metaphor, pretty careless, must subtract points, Bill, but he's very rationally considering the issue of self-slaughter, would have deeply unsettled the early modern audience, which saw suicide as absolutely traumatic. Not that we don't today, obviously. But for that world, there is a theological dimension that we've largely abandoned. But this does, to return to my earlier analogy, make Hamlet a man out of place, sort of, even out of time, actually. He says, quote, "The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that ever I was born to set it right." Some characteristic solipsism there, perhaps, but a keen awareness of his incompatibility with the world as he finds it. As a way of attempting to reconcile these competing values and perspectives, Hamlet's characteristic forms of speech are the question and the pun. And this is not to say that he only speaks in these forms, but they do mark his dialogue conspicuously. In fact, his first two lines in the play are puns. Quote, "A little more than kin and less than kind," and, quote, "Not so, my lord, I am too much in the sun." Now, both speeches pun on Hamlet's now uncomfortably close relationship to Uncle Father Claudius. His conversation with Polonius about Ophelia, "Let her not walk in the sun. Conception is a blessing, but not as your daughter may conceive," puns on conception as both formulation and fertilization. The line, quote, "Do you think I meant country matters?" to Ophelia at the play within a play, puns on the pudendum, and so on and so on. Now, come to think of it, that quizzical love poem of his, "Doubt thou that the stars are fire, doubt thou that the sun doth move, doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love." It's quizzical because the word doubt had two meanings, almost contronymic, that is, almost antonyms of themselves. Doubt could mean, as we think of it now, be skeptical, but it could also mean be suspicious. So you could say, be skeptical that I love you, or be suspicious that I love you. And these are two wildly different ideas captured in the same language. So the pun may be, as many have noted, the lowest form of wit, but those folks are usually grumbling because they didn't think of it first. In Hamlet's case, I think the use of puns, exploiting a word's multiplicity of meanings, is part and parcel of his attempts to sort out the meaning of things, the meaning of meaning, actually. When Polonius asks him what he reads, he responds quite literally, quote, "words, words, words." There's a notion that, as he says to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that there is, quote, "nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." A very relativistic and subjective position to take, that things have no essential meanings or properties except what we take them to be. And usually that taking manifests in language, and the problem is that language has no fixed meanings itself. So how can it be the arbiter of meaning to other things? His use of question is to the same purpose. Indeed, well, that's what questions are for, aren't they? To probe the meanings of things. An astounding number of his lines are interrogative, always skeptical, always suspicious, doubtful, curious, frightened, yearning. What strikes many readers and audience members as indecision, I think, may actually be a matter of genuine nescience. Contrasting this is the cocksure confidence of King Claudius. Wow, honestly, I did not intend that annoying alliteration. Or that assonance. I suppose one of the problems with our reading or watching of Hamlet nowadays is that the story is so well known. As I said earlier, most folks know something about it. And so many of us go in knowing that Claudius is the bad guy and that both he and Hamlet die in the heat of vengeance. And yeah, probably original audiences knew that too. You know, but what if you didn't? What if you didn't? Some of you, I'm sure, came to this play for the first time. If you didn't know the story, would you necessarily think that Claudius was the antagonist? At least for the first half. When we first meet Claudius, he's addressing his court, very probably for the first time. He laments the passing of his brother, announces his marriage to Gertrude, then smoothly transitions to the business of monarchy. He dispatches ambassadors to the King of Norway seeking a diplomatic resolution to that king's nephew Fortinbras' planned invasion of Denmark. The embassy returns victorious. Valtemar reports that Norway, quote, "set out to suppress his nephew's levies, which to him appeared to be a preparation against the Polak, but better looked into, he truly found it was against your highness. Whereat, grieved that so his sickness, age, and impotence was forcibly borne in hand, sends out arrests on Fortinbras, which he, in brief, obeys, receives rebuke from Norway, and, in fine, makes vow before his uncle nevermore to give the assay of arms against your majesty." That's a quite deft bit of statecraft, wouldn't you agree? An invasion deterred by skillful negotiation and diplomacy. Claudius seems quite an effective and, indeed, progressive leader. He secures a peaceful resolution to a problem that his medieval, martial, conquest king brother started. And when we do hear that Claudius murdered that older brother, I think we have every right to be skeptical. The ghost reveals to the prince,
"'Tis given out that sleeping in my orchard a serpent stung me. So the whole ear of Denmark is by a forged process of my death rankly abused. But know, thou noble youth, the serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown."
To which Hamlet replies, quote, Oh, my prophetic soul, my uncle! Okay, Hamlet doesn't like Claudius. Kind of grossed out by the thought of him and Mom doing the dirty and seems sometimes resentful about not being king himself. But taking the word of a ghost that he can't identify and whose motives he suspects does not convince me, at this moment anyway, that we should jump along with him to that conclusion. It is not unreasonable to withhold our assent from the ghost's charge. And besides, don't you feel the Garden of Eden illusion a bit bang on for comfort? Of course, we would be wrong, as it turns out. Claudius is indeed the murderous usurper, the ghost claims, as we hear in his soliloquy after the play within a play. Quote, "Oh, my offense is rank, it smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder." And the Cain and Abel allusion nicely completes the Eden reference I just disparaged. Right, so we know that Claudius is a villain. But I always find this soliloquy remarkably, you know, humanizing, I guess. He knows that he has committed grave evil, and he would like to be repentant, but he can't be, because he's unwilling to make restitution. He's unwilling to sacrifice, quote, "those effects for which I did the murder, my crown, mine own ambition, and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense." Have we not all felt like this? That we've gained some prize we've coveted by less than honorable means, and we feel awful about it, but yet still can't shed the desire that motivated us in the first place? I mean, I don't imagine many of us have killed our brother, married his widow, and usurped a throne, but I'm sure we've all got things that nibble at our conscience a bit. A speech like this, as I said, humanizes Claudius. Shakespeare doesn't portray some mustache-twirling villain, not some inhuman monster. He shows us a man, capable and fallible. There's an interesting little line, by the by, from this speech that I want to bring up later, so just remember it now. The distraught king tries to comfort himself and says, quote, "All may be well." Now remember that, okay? So we really don't get a clear read on Claudius until about halfway through the play, and that makes me wonder about Claudius's new wife, Gertrude, the widow Hamlet. What does she know about him, actually? She's a character that doesn't say much. Most of her speeches, indeed, are one line, but yet she's often on stage, in our view. And that kind of silent presence just makes me wonder what she's thinking this whole time. What's she up to? You know, who's there? She's been portrayed in myriad ways on stage and on screen, often, for some reason, as a dissipated woman, drunken and licentious. It often works if done well and without relying on misogynistic cliches, but actually I'm not totally convinced it's supported by the text. And then again, she has so little text that there's a wide latitude for portrayals. I've seen scheming Machiavellian Gertrudes and disdainful Gertrudes and weepy Gertrudes and earnest Gertrudes. As an aside, when you've the time, check out a short story by Margaret Atwood called Gertrude Talks Back. It's an interesting angle, that. I'll put a link in the show notes if I can find one. Her son, however, certainly sees her as the lascivious lush. The abuse he heaps upon her makes one cringe, and that he does so with such a smug sense of self-righteousness galls. Quote, "Frailty, thy name is woman," he hisses in his first soliloquy. In the closet scene, after he disowns her, he rampages that she lives, quote, "in the rank sweat of an enseamed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty." Yet her reactions to all his accusations are tantalizingly ambiguous. She says, quote, "Oh, Hamlet, speak no more. Thou turn'st mine eyes into my very soul. And there I see such black and grained spots as will not leave their tinct." Is she just putting two and two together now? Or has she always been in on the plot? Was her marriage to old Hamlet happy? Were she and Claudius lovers before the murder? Or was she merely a pawn in a vicious case of sibling rivalry? In fact, had she any choice at all in marrying Claudius? Ah, so many questions. And the relationship between her and Ophelia, the only other woman in the play, is similarly unclear. Their first appearance together feels formal and somewhat distant. After Polonius's murder, Gertrude puts off their meeting, quote, "I will not speak with her." And then, curiously, it is Gertrude who reports, in what some see as rather suspicious detail, Ophelia's death by drowning. Quote, "There is a willow grows ascant the brook. There on the pendant boughs her cornet weeds clambering to hang, an envious sliver broke when down her weedy trophies and herself fell into the weeping brook. Her clothes spread wide, and mermaid-like, a while they bore her up, which time she chanted snatches of old lauds as one incapable of her own distress, or like a creature native and undued unto that element. But long it could not be till that her garments, heavy with their drink, pulled the poor wretch from her melodious lay to muddy death." Run to her? Call to her? Maybe get some help? Tell her how much she has to live for, no? Just watch her fall, float about a bit, then sink? Well, it's a lovely speech all the same. And then at the poor girl's funeral, Gertrude offers a parting lament that has, as far as I can tell, no logical precedent in their relationship. Quote, "I hoped thou should hast been my Hamlet's wife. I thought thy bride bed to have decked, sweet maid, and not have strewed thy grave." What? Really? When? Bit late for any show of sisterhood, Gert. But my favorite bit with Gertrude comes just at the very end. Hamlet and Laertes are fencing, and Claudius has poisoned Hamlet's Gatorade. During a break, Gertrude takes up the cup. Quote, "The queen carouses to thy fortune, Hamlet." Claudius makes the world's feeblest attempt to stop her. "Gertrude, do not drink." And for the first time in the whole play, maybe even her whole life, Gertrude defies a man's orders and does what she wants to. Quote, "I will, my lord. I pray you pardon me." Oh! And then she dies. But it's such an open scene, so full of dramatic possibilities. Is she just that lush who drinks the poison in ignorance? Does she know the wine is poisonous and decides that suicide is her best option? Or does she realize what Claudius intends and, in perhaps a long-delayed act of motherhood, drinks to save her son? You can play it any way, and probably more, because the lines are so elastic and so pregnant. Let's have a look at Ophelia, since we were just mentioning her. She's another character with comparatively few lines, but a constant presence. So we've talked about her suicide, or death, I guess, technically. We don't know for sure that she took her own life, though both the gravedigger and the funeral priest seem to think so. At any rate, we clearly see that the death of her father at the hand of her beloved has been, disturbing. Reports reach the queen of Ophelia's mental breakdown. Ophelia enters Gertrude's presence, singing songs that seem to be for her dead father, insisting that Gertrude listen attentively. And then she begins to speak what seems gibberish, but includes a really cutting observation, quote, "Lord, we know what we are, but know not what we may be." That question of identity and selfhood and agency again. Anyway, then she starts singing another song, this time a bawdy tavern number, about a young man who broke his promise to a willing young woman. She sings, quote, "Let in the maid that out a maid never departed more." Is this a hint? The song continues, quote, "Quoth she, before you tumbled me, you promised me to wed." He answers, "So would I a done by yonder sun, and thou hadst not come to my bed." Oh, traditional scholars aver that Ophelia is virginal throughout the play, and they've excellent reasons. But this song, even in her madness, seems a bit on the nose, especially in light of her brother Laertes' advice back in Act 1. And if Ophelia had consented to sleep with Hamlet, that would explain her apparent complete mental collapse, much more so than the death of a father to whom she never seemed very close. I'm not saying she wouldn't have mourned him at all, but that Hamlet was the murderer and that she perhaps sacrificed her virginity to him, well, that's catastrophic. Not only because she would be unmarriageable in the Danish court and a pariah in its society, but look, hardly ever does Ophelia think or act for herself. So many of her speeches are submissions to men, quote, so please you, and quote, I do not know, my lord, what I should think, and quote, I shall obey, my lord. She's always been defined in terms of her relationship to the men in her life, her brother's sister, her father's daughter, her lover's lover. And when these are gone, she lacks definition. She becomes nothing. Hence this traumatic psychological collapse. Now, many have pointed out that Ophelia, like Laertes and Fortinbras, is something of a foil for Hamlet. You know, whereas he feigns madness, does he? She actually loses her sanity. Does she? Where he contemplates suicide, she actually commits it. She reifies his abstractions. What for him is intellectual becomes for her actual. Unless she's more cunning than we give her credit for. Now look, I know I'm going out on a long, wobbly limb here, and I'm not a skinny fella, but all of that applies only if she's actually mad. What if Ophelia, too, thought it meet to put on the old antic disposition? Pace Polonius, if this be madness, there is method in it. Ophelia appears singing songs that easily could refer to her affair with the prince. And then when Claudius comes to investigate, she murmurs, I hope all will be well. Boy, that sounds to me an awful lot like what the king said at the end of his soliloquy. And I just love the idea. Now, one without any textual support whatsoever, I grant you. I love the idea, though, that Ophelia heard him too. She was there. She knows. Then she distributes the flowers. Quote, there's rosemary, that's for remembrance. Pray you, love, remember. And there is pansies, that's for thoughts. There's fennel for you and columbines. There's rue for you, and here's some for me. We may call it herba grace of Sundays. You must wear your rue with a difference. There's a daisy. I would give you some violets, but they withered all when my father died. The flower's symbolic meanings have never been satisfactorily settled, and we've no idea to whom each flower is given, but we can safely assume there's a symmetry here. Rue, for example, may symbolize bitterness and, incidentally, was sometimes used at the time to end pregnancies. Curiouser and curiouser. She seems deeply aware of the people and events around her. I wonder if Ophelia is not simply Hamlet's foil, but his doppelganger. Oh, there are so many more characters I could talk about. Polonius, you know, what kind of parent is he? He's often portrayed as a doddering old fool, but he manages to pull off some pretty sophisticated political moves. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Well, I think Tom Stoppard did a hell of a stroke exploring them, but are they mere fools, mindless pawns? Did they deserve to die, really? Oh, and the gravedigger! As so often in Shakespeare's plays, it's the clown character who speaks the greatest truths. You know, does Yorick count as a character? The jester in old Hamlet's court, whose skull the prince addresses with perhaps the most vulnerable affection he has ever shown. I love this speech. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorred in my imagination it is. My gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed I know not how oft. Where be your jibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar? Not one now to mock your own grinning. I sometimes think that old Hamlet was Hamlet's father, but Yorick was Hamlet's dad. And that puts a weird spin on the whole revenge plot. And what about Horatio, Hamlet's best, perhaps only, if we don't count the skull, friend? The fella he calls, quote, as just a man as e'er my conversation coped withal. Horatio is the play's Renaissance humanist scholar par excellence. In the play's opening scene, he is skeptical about the guard's reports of the ghostly apparition. He regularly urges caution and measured action. Hamlet chides him with one of my favorite lines of all time, quote, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." And of course, he's the only major character who survives the play's climactic bloodbath. Hamlet dies in his lap after urging him, quote, "O God, Horatio, what a wounded name, things standing thus unknown, shall I leave behind me. If thou didst ever hold me in thy heart, absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain, to tell my story." Which Horatio does when Fortinbras arrives to claim the throne. But beyond that, Horatio's charge stands as the final metadramatic moment in the play. You know, whenever we watch Hamlet on stage or on screen, whenever we read the text, Horatio is in some way fulfilling his friend's dying request. I really like to think that. I mentioned at the top of this episode that the late Professor Bloom declared that with Hamlet, Shakespeare invented the human. If this hyperbole is rooted in truth, then Shakespeare's invention makes great use of the tools and materials provided by 16th century inventor of the essay, Michel de Montaigne, who wrote in one, quote, "Every one of us is a hodgepodge, so shapeless and diverse in structure that each piece, each moment plays its own game, and there is as much difference between us and ourselves as there is between us and others." 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche asserted that Shakespeare was Montaigne's best reader, and I'm hard-pressed to think of a more elegant précis of the tragedy of Hamlet than Montaigne's pithy observation. Maybe this one. Quote, "Every man bears the whole stamp of the human condition." But that's Montaigne again. Hamlet has hardly been out of production in the 4+ centuries since its debut. Somewhere, someone right now is telling the prince's story, or all of his stories. But not only his, Ophelia's too, and Claudius's, and Gertrude's, and, of course, our own. Whew, that was a long one, huh? And I'm sure that as soon as I post this, I'll think of a dozen other things I could have talked about. Drop me a line, really, if there's anything about Hamlet you'd like to hear about. We can do more. Thanks for listening, everyone. And thank you to all who have left reviews on their platforms. That really helps attract new listeners. And thank you to all who've told others about the show. That's a great, great help as well. I really, really do appreciate all your support. Subscribe to the show and follow it on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube to get announcements and notifications. All right, folks. The rest is silence.